Today, as we celebrate our 225th anniversary of this church here in Shalott, you'll hear about some of the challenges that we have faced as a church and how our members, with God's help, rose to the occasion. My grandfather used to tell this story. It's one of those stories that sometimes you've heard 20 times, and I'd like to share it with you. My grandfather used to tell the story, "Our family is like a hill of potatoes. The best ones are in the ground." Well, after this morning, we may have some of you thinking that the best members of this church are in the ground. I wish to acknowledge the contributions for much of what I'm saying and sharing with you to three longtime church members who joined the church in the 60s and the 70s. I interviewed Ann Belosky, Ann Hancock, and Dorothy Pellet, and asked them this question: when did the church face real trouble in the past, and how did we survive? It was Ann Belosky who straightened me out, as she sometimes does. When she answered, "I'm not sure we ever were in real trouble, but we sure found ourselves encountering a lot of challenges." Geography was the first obstacle we encountered here in Shalott in 1792. We have a high ridge running through the middle of us from north to south. Today, with the availability of automobiles, it's hard for most of us to realize how important the physical location of the church sanctuary would be for all Shalotters to attend. This decision took several committees and 6 years to make. Prayer and compromise finally settled it. Probably the lowest attendance in this church was in the early years between 1799 and 1807, when we got down to just 11 members. But somehow, thankfully, we experienced a revival of membership that year with 40 new members joining the church. In 1848, we experienced our first facilities crisis, not our last, but our first. Our first wooden church burned, but it didn't take us long to decide to rebuild. During that winter, the stone that formed the foundation to this building was hauled across Lake Champlain on the ice. And it was my great-great-uncles, the Kehoes, who did the masonry work on the brick in this building. Soon after, in 1862, the Civil War ripped this community apart, as well as the country. To give you an idea of how much this affected Shalott and our church, I happen to know how it affected my family, and I'll share that with you. My great-grandmother, who attended this church after she got kicked out of the Catholic Church for having married a Protestant. My great-grandmother, who attended this church, was kept busy with five children, a small farm, added to her task turning sheets into bandages for the war effort with the other women in this church. They met in this church and made those bandages, which might end up on their own husband. Her husband and three of her brothers were off fighting in the Civil War. Two of the four were killed. One came down with malaria fighting in New Orleans, and her husband became disabled with rheumatoid arthritis as a result of being forced to cross the Potomac with his wet clothes freezing to him. The men were not allowed to build a fire to warm themselves in fear that their location would be given away. The next crisis happened in 1918, which was the only time in the history of this church that we had to completely stop services. For 5 weeks, we did not worship together due to the epidemic of the Spanish influenza. In the 1930s, the people in Shalott, as well as the world, experienced the Great Depression, which presented a great challenge to our church. I've looked quite extensively to see how we handled that as a church. And much of the credit should go to our minister at that time, Dr. Hall. The fact that Dr. Hall also served as a UVM professor and was being paid there seems to help justify to our congregation that he didn't need to get a full salary here. nor did he get a raise during that entire period of several years. It was in 1960 that I remember a great deal of tension in this church. The anti-war movement was just gaining steam in the country and in the state. We had a young minister, Reverend Richard Neal, who wrote to a church member sometime after he left, indicating that the major reason he left was, "I had a meeting on alternatives to peace." The speaker was then Representative Bill Myers. The church fathers forbid me to have the meeting in the church, so we had it in the parsonage. My memories from that time were that it was a few of the veterans who had fought in World War II that led the crusade against our minister. Ever since then, whenever a minister gives a sermon questioning the war that our country is fighting, I cringe, start to feel very uneasy, wondering who will get fired next. A month or so ago, Nat asked me as historian, "Is it true that the ceiling fell down several years ago?" And I said, "It was then that I realized that not everybody has attended this church as long as I have." And I decided I might share some of these hard times with you. It was in 1983, the week before Anne Hancock had held a memorial service in here for Ruth Orr, and the church had been completely packed. The ceiling fell down from the very front of the church to the middle chandelier. When we investigated the debris, which some of it, by the way, is in our museum over there, you'll see a lot of this interesting stuff over there. When we investigated the debris, it became clear that three ceilings had been hitched on top of one another, only with nails. No one was hurt, but the estimate to repair was $200,000. Our insurance did not cover it because, of course, it was an act of God. It's funny how we give them credit for the bad things, huh? My mother told me that the first major contribution of $1,000 to our repair fund came from the East Shalott Catholic Church. We had just gone through the laborious task of completing our church profile and interviewing and hiring a new minister. His name was Reverend Robert Gormley. I'm pretty sure God guided us in our selection because we had no idea that we would need a minister who could help us raise the funds. However, that is exactly what happened. God continues to look after us, and we were able once again to pull together. So even now, after having thought about it, discussing it with three longtime members, I'm not sure what part of meeting these challenges God has played. However, I do know, as do others who have ever witnessed God's acts in this church and through this church, that God is here and in our members. When we really want to accomplish something good, it can and often does happen. I trust in the Lord that this church will be here 75 years from now and to celebrate its 300th anniversary and to open the time capsule. As Dorothy Pellet said, it can be here if we want it to be here. And it is here now because people have wanted it to be here for the past 225 years. In thinking about what the challenges were to this church, I realize that we have just been through one with the transfer of our previous pastor, Will Burhans. We're very fortunate to have Susan willing to lead us through these times. As I look back, it seems that Susan has made the transition seamless to us. Susan has sacrificed to do so, willing to expand and contract her work hours to suit this church's needs. Thank you.
Thank you, Jeannie, very much. Several weeks ago, I called the Vermont Conference to see if they had any way of knowing where we stood in the lineup of churches within the conference that had held continuous services since the 1700s. No one had ever asked that question, apparently, and short of my calling a bunch of other churches to inquire, we just don't know for sure. But my guess is that there aren't more than a handful of congregations that can boast this claim. Maybe just a couple. I'm aware of congregations formed in the 19th century that closed for decades and then reopened, some only to close again, or to then merge with other churches in town. It's daunting and humbling to think that services have been held here for so long, so regularly, so religiously. Believe me, there were times in the past couple of years when fear and trembling overtook me, and I had to calm myself by remembering that for 225 years, this church had been a shining beacon on the hill, and it probably wouldn't die on my watch. It steadied my thumping heart. In looking back at my brief 9 years here, I've gotten a flavor both of discord and solidarity. Some of you may have heard that when the steeple needed to be replaced, some members felt it was essential and others thought it was a low priority, feeling that our resources should go towards the ministries of the church. This is a familiar tension in most congregations, including ours. It's about money, and it's also about priorities and intentions, our collective sense of calling and ministry. There will always be those among us who will want to shore up the endowment as a sandbag against a storm. Others will hold with a more open window view of church finances, in one window and out the other into the world. Many congregations don't have this luxury at all, since what paltry money they have must go immediately to essential upkeep. The tension between maintaining buildings and mission work in the world is a vital part of the living organism that is the church. I thank God that these buildings have been maintained so that people can come here and be safe and warm. I am so grateful to those who have seen it as their ministry to preserve and protect this sanctuary. Call it a building if you want. But it's more than that. It's a sanctuary where we can come to worship God and pray for guidance and solace and strength and grace and forgiveness. We come in good times and we come in bad. We come today to celebrate and give thanks for the faithful witness of countless generations who have preserved for us this place. But more than that, this hope, this faith, this fortress against violence, injustice, and war, this sacred space in which to question our lives, our God, our purpose on earth. There is something that I tend to ask myself more often than is comfortable. What I ask is simply this: what are you doing? There's a remove in the question, as you may have noticed, an employment of some objective appraisal. I don't say, what am I doing? What are you doing? I'd let myself get away with far too much if I only had myself to answer to. I admit that there's more than a casual suggestion that the one asking the question might just bear a vague resemblance to the big JC. When Jesus called Peter to come to him, Peter, thrilled and excited, got out and immediately started walking on the water, just like Jesus. How cool was that? Until the wind blew hard and Peter got scared and a little voice in his head said something like, oh my gosh, yikes, what am I doing? The wind will blow me over. I can't walk on water. And he began to sink. Lord, save me, he cried to Jesus. And Jesus reached out a hand and pulled him into the boat and the wind immediately stilled. The winds of war are blowing strong in our country right now. We have this week been forced to face the chill threat of nuclear war, of purposely inflammatory, provocative, and incendiary statements uttered by our highest elected official, who ostensibly speaks in the best interest of our country and our children and our grandchildren. Nuclear war is not in our children's best interest, period. So the question is, what are you doing? What are we as individuals and as a congregation doing? We thought this morning's service would be about the past, about reflecting on the way God has somehow sustained this community through difficult times. Jeannie spoke wonderfully about this. But we have an urgent calling before us right now, and it is not time to rest on our laurels. As Jesus called to Peter, so does he call to us right now. We are being asked to do the apparently impossible, to walk on the water of peace, confident in our ability not to be subsumed by the fire and the fury of war, to divert a course that is purportedly locked and loaded. Do you feel inconsequential? Do you bemoan your ability to make any difference at all? Do you feel yourselves sinking? Do you pray for peace and chew your nails? The question for us right now is, what are you doing? Like Peter, we will drown if we let our fear paralyze us. And if we think that somehow the world will not let nuclear annihilation happen, we'd best wake up and realize that those who control the arsenals of power in this instance are nil. There are no checks and balances on our president's ability to push the nuclear football. It is for us to rise up and demand that our representatives protect and safeguard diplomacy and peace. As women in the past gathered in this church to rip their sheets into bandages, so must we gather on this hill in the house of God and in faith recall the prophet Isaiah's proclamation, "Come, let us go to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of God of Jacob, that we may learn of God's ways and walk in the paths of God. For God shall judge between the nations and shall arbitrate for the peoples. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. And nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more." Grace and peace. Grace and peace.